In his latest book called American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields, Rowan Jacobson talks about the concept of terroir and what it means, why Europeans have believed in it for years, and why it's only recently been embraced by Americans. In his travels from a sugar house in Vermont to an avocado grove in Mexico, the James Beard Award-winning author tasted his way across North America, sampling local foods and interacting with the farmers who produce them. Rowan Jacobson was on our show in November to discuss American terroir, and we thought that we would re-air that conversation for you on this long holiday weekend. I started off by noting that for his last book, A Geography of Oysters, he toured the coastline of North America, tasting how oysters differ from region to region. And I asked Rowan Jacobson, is this a continuation of that idea?
Yeah, in a sense. When I was doing that book, I was also focusing on why the oysters in each bay taste different from each other. And it's the same idea of terroir, the taste of place. And so that kind of, you know, got – I had my terroir eyes on after that. And as I would talk to people about that – they would come back to me with all these other foods, and they'd say, well, you know, that's true for this and this too.
Well, I wonder about those oysters, even though that's the previous book, because they're all growing in the Atlantic Ocean, aren't they? Is the water that different along one coast than another?
Absolutely. And it's all the same species of oysters from the maritime provinces all the way down the coast and even around into the Gulf of Mexico, all the same species. So the differences in flavor are all because of the environment.
What kind of environment are we talking about? Are we talking about microclimate or are we talking about something larger?
Yeah, no, I'd say microclimate is definitely the way to look at it because, well, one really clear example is salinity. Oysters, because they're filter feeders, they're just pumping water through their bodies all day to filter out their food. And so they basically take on the whatever's in that water is going to be in that oyster. And the salt level in the oyster would be exactly the same as the water they're in.
Now, in the past, whenever I've heard the term terroir, it's always been applied to wine. But is that the way it was – is that what it was invented for, or do Europeans apply it to anything that could be used as food?
It did start with wine. Goût de terroir, the taste of the earth, the phrase was originally applied to wines. It was considered a defect if you're going back 400 or 500 years ago. It was, you know, like saying you can take the wine off the farm, but you can't take the farm out of the wine, right? It tasted of the earth, and people didn't like that. Then that people, I think, were looking for a more refined taste then. Now we kind of like foods where you can taste something of the place they came from.
And when Europeans criticized American wine, they criticized the fact that terroir was not a major consideration. Americans said, well, we don't have to worry about that. We'll make the wine taste good in the winemaking process. Now we're hearing more and more American winemakers using the phrase terroir and thinking about where they're going to plant this grape as opposed to where they're going to plant that other grape.
Exactly. And I think it's a real maturation of the American wine industry that we're no longer trying to mimic European wines through manipulation in the lab.
And the same thing, I would assume, applies to all the things that you write about in this book, whether it's maple syrup or cheese or honey or, I guess, carrots and broccoli.
Yeah, I assume it's true for everything. And the way I chose my subjects was really where I could get enough information to really dig into that subject and prove it more or less.
Well, we've always known about it to some degree, haven't we? We've always known that fine cheeses are made in Vermont, that Georgia produces some of the best peaches. Wouldn't that be an extension of the concept of terroir?
Totally. And I think one of the best examples is black dirt onions, black dirt shallots from, right in New York State, the super rich mucklands from a glacial lake of 12,000 years ago produced these incredibly intense onions.
And that's because they're grown in a soil that has certain minerals?
Right. More minerals, a lot more sulfur, which is where onions get their fire from, and just much more organic matter.
So the trick for the farmer would be to grow onions there but not grow something else that might not react as well to what's in the soil.
And that's a good point. What's good terroir for one type of food might be terrible for something else. So I think what's happened in Europe is over hundreds of years, they've managed to, you know, work out what works where, and we're really just getting started on that road.
And European winemakers will tell you that you want to grow this certain grape on the side of the hill that gets the sun and sea breezes. You want the other grape to grow on the other side of the hill that gets less sun.
Right, and that can make a big difference. And in Europe, they want to get as much sun as they can because that's a limiting factor. In California, it's starting to look like some of the best wines are going to be made on the North Slopes, which is just anathema to a European winemaker. But in California, you kind of got to get away from that sun.
My guest is Rowan Jacobson, whose latest book is called American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. It is published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How far can we extend this? If we see somebody who has apple orchards, do we actually try to find some kind of distinction between the apples that grew in this field as opposed to the next orchard?
I'm sure we could. And often, you know, if you ask people who have had an orchard for a long time, they know it already. They'll know that these apples are a little different than those, almost just, you know, instinctively. But they've never made a big deal out of it or even thought about promoting that fact. They may have even thought about not promoting that fact. So paying attention to those kind of differences in a country that's used to products having a lot of homogeneity is sort of a whole new way of looking at things.
Last night, we did a food event here at WNYC, and we talked about cheeses. And one of the things that came up was whether a cheese tastes different if the animals are eating clover or eating some grain or hay that's been brought in.
Big factor. And I know that there's been studies in Europe that have shown that mountain cheeses have more diversity of flavor than valley cheeses, because in the mountains there's much more different pasture, more different species that they're foraging on.
On the other hand, cows love to go into gullies. That's their natural inclination. So
exactly.
Yeah, we have to teach them how to climb mountains.
Well, certain cows are a lot better at it.
Right now, one of the most popular things at the local green market is New York honey. And who would have thought that honey from bees that are living in the city would be so rich?
Yeah, you know, the New York City honey that I've tasted is fantastic. I think it's probably because there's such a huge range of flowers that those bees are foraging on all across the city.
You write that your neighbor grows more flavorful carrots than most you've tried. Is it possible that carrots grown from the same seeds can taste that different depending on where they're planted?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely, because if you know, what a root vegetable in particular is just pulling into itself all the water from the dirt around it, and it's getting carbon sent down from the leaves. But with that water, it's also pulling in all the minerals it needs. And different soils can be very different in mineral content.
How can people apply this kind of knowledge to their backyard gardens?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think it would be very fun to play around with something, especially like a potato or a carrot, something where the soil is going to have a really big influence. And, you know, keep your plots separate, just like a winery does with its blocks of grapes.
So, and then keep a record of which did well and which didn't do so well.
Yeah.
And then plant in the thing that did best.
Right. And over time, you would probably develop some particular strains. And it would be pretty wonky, but it might be fun.
Although this doesn't apply when you're growing tomatoes in a pot, does it? Because that soil is the stuff you bought at the local nursery or even some hardware store.
Absolutely. Yeah. In terms of soil content, if you're adding, if you look at industrial agriculture, you're not going to get much of a sense of terroir because mostly what those plants are growing on are chemical fertilizers.
Is it true that plants that live in difficult conditions and struggle to grow often taste better?
Yeah, a little torture tends to make plants taste better.
I know. Why is that? Because they're struggling to get all of those minerals out of the soil?
Yeah, they have to work harder. With grapes, it's pretty well known that if they're a little bit stressed, the vines will have to dig a lot deeper in search of water. And deeper down, they're also going to get a lot more mineral content than right on the surface.
In traveling across the country, did you find that people were using the term terroir, or is this something that you extrapolated from what they were saying.
In traveling around the country, I find that people have an incredibly difficult time pronouncing the word terroir. It's actually, it turned out to be more intimidating than I expected. People that understand the concept, they mostly, especially if they're working in the world of agriculture, or aquaculture especially, they definitely have a sense of that concept. But the word is only now starting to creep out of the wine world.
Mm. Well, on the other hand, it's something that we apply to all of this new thinking about organic foods and locavore eating. But when we've discussed locavore on the show in the past, there are always a few listeners who complain that we're being elitist. Is this something that really appeals most to those who can afford to pay more for their foods?
A terroir or locavore?
Yeah, the whole business of thinking about terroir and its impact on the foods that we eat.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny how fast the whole food system has changed, that we're now arguing that it's elitist to not fly your food in from Chile. It seems to be so counterintuitive what's happened. It's elitist to grow food in your own backyard now. And it is true that it costs more because of, because of the oil economy, basically. But in terms of the amount of money, the percentage of income that we spend on food, traditionally, even if you're buying local organic products, you're still spending what throughout human history has been a pretty normal amount of money on food.
When people like Alice Waters are accused of being elitist, they argue that we subsidize agribusinesses, and if we helped out small farmers who are more likely to grow good-tasting and healthier produce, that we would see those prices drop. There was an article in the New York Times recently that revealed that the USDA's Dairy Management Department helped Domino's Pizza and other chains get through rough times by making cheese available to them at reduced costs. And then the USDA said that all this new cheese is now one of the causes of obesity.
Yeah, that article really struck a chord with a lot of people, including me. But yeah, I think you find that on a level playing field, organic food competes perfectly well.
Why do you think we don't do that sort of thing? Is it because we think in terms of making as much as possible at the lowest possible cost? It's like a manufacturing model.
Yeah, and we've shifted the dollars from, or the energy away from human energy to oil energy, and that has been a cheaper way to go for the past 40 years. But I think it's probably going to swing back in the next 40.
So are you one of those people who believes that eating locally is the best way?
Yes, no.
What do we do about oranges, for example? And what do you do if you're in northern Maine and all you can grow is some potatoes and rutabagas in the wintertime?
Right. And I live up in Vermont, and we every August, there's a big tradition in central Vermont of having locavore month with a vengeance, where you don't eat anything that came from more than 50 miles away. But I've been thinking about that, and it really, trade has been a pretty positive impact on human civilization. So I feel like the rule should be if your area can do something perfectly well, then it's kind of a sin to get it from somewhere far away. But if your area can't do something well, then it's great to trade with somebody else.
Some people argue that the real concern here is helping local economies thrive, so that if you're buying a cheese that's from Wisconsin, even though it's being shipped in from Wisconsin, if you're helping a local cheesemaker make a better product, then that's just as good as only buying a cheese that was made 50 miles away.
Yeah, I agree. And, one of the reasons I wrote the book and wanted to focus on local flavor is because then you're not just buying locally because you feel like it's the right thing to do. It gives you more of a, you're buying for your palate as well as your superego.
My guest is Rowan Jacobson, who writes about food, the environment, and the connections between the two. And his work has appeared in The Art of Eating, The New York Times, Harper's Newsweek, Eating Well, and other publications. He's also the author of a number of books One of them, a James Beard Award winner called Geography of Oysters. That's his last book. And now we have American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. It is published by Bloomsbury. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with a conversation I had in November with Rowan Jacobson. He was here to discuss his book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. Before the break, Rowan had mentioned living in Vermont, the source of a lot of maple syrup, at least in good years, and I asked him how important is terroir for maple syrup. When I go to the supermarket, there's Canadian Amber, there's Vermont, there's upstate New York maple syrups. Can you really taste the difference?
Not necessarily from mega areas. I couldn't generalize, but you can definitely taste the difference between maple syrup coming from geologically different sugar bushes. A high mountain maple syrup will have a different flavor from one that's lower down, and bedrock makes a difference too. Maple syrup with maple trees on schist will be different than those on, say, limestone.
Do all maple trees provide syrups?
The sugar maple is the big workhorse maple for maple syrup. You can also make it out of the red maple, which grows down closer to here. But it gets late in the season, the sap gets some bitter tasting components in it, and it happens a lot earlier with red maple than sugar, which is why sugar is called sugar maple.
And those trees tend to thrive in cooler climates. Could we get maple syrup from Florida?
No. The only place in the world you can get maple syrup is there's kind of a big triangle from Minnesota over to Quebec and down maybe to Pennsylvania.
And that's because of the soil?
And climate, really, is a big one. Sugar maples are adapted to a pretty cold climate. And it's going to be a big issue in coming years in Vermont. The big discussion is, are all the sugar maples going to migrate north to Quebec, and we're just going to be left with oaks?
Well, I imagine that people discovered that they could do something with maple syrup because it was already leaking out of some trees.
The squirrels were the first ones to discover it. As trees would get gashes in them and the sap would slowly leak out and evaporate, it would leave the sugary residue, and the squirrels would go and lap it. And so Native Americans observed the squirrels doing that and thought, they're on to something.
And were the Native Americans the ones who realized that if you boiled down this tree sap, you'd make a syrup?
They did, although they didn't have metal. So their method for doing it was heating up rocks and then dropping the rocks into these buckets with the sap. So it must have been just, you know, painfully inefficient. And so then when the colonists arrived with metal buckets, then they took it to a whole nother level.
How long does the season last?
Just a few sweet weeks in March, usually a little bit of February. It's a big event in Vermont. Everyone has parties in the sugar because it's, you know, it's still cold there. But then, as the sap is boiling in these little wooden sugar houses, it's kind of like a sauna, a steam room, and so everyone gathers in there.
And then every so often, we're told that this is a bad year for maple syrup. Is that because there wasn't enough rain during the summer?
It's because in order for the sap to flow up the maple trees, you have to have this freeze-thaw mechanism, which kind of pumps the sap up. So you need days that rise into the 40s, but then nights that fall below freezing. And only it's that expansion and contraction that happens as the sap in the trees thaw and freeze that makes it happen. So as soon as you no longer get nights below freezing, the season's done.
I've always wondered why it's only maple trees that do this. There's sap in all trees, isn't there?
Yeah, and you can make sap from. I've tried with a couple different trees. I tried making sap out of a birch tree, but It was inedible. But I know in Alaska, there's a big birch syrup industry with the paper birches. But most trees have a lot of bitter compounds in their sap. Maple trees are kind of unique in that they don't.
You also write about Esmeralda's special coffee that's found in Panama, which once sold for a record-breaking $100 a pound, while most wholesale coffee runs to $2 to $3 a pound. It's selling for about what silver sells for a pound, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely.
Is it that good?
It's darn good.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess if you got $100 and you're really wealthy and it doesn't really matter, $100 is the same as $10, then you might buy this coffee.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of Dutch tulip mania that took hold, but it was because this type of coffee tree called a geisha, this variety, it was suddenly, when planted very high at about 5,000 feet on this Panamanian mountain, it started producing coffee beans with flavors that had never been tasted in the Americas before in a coffee. So there, famously, one well-known coffee buyer said it tasted like he was drinking God in a cup, which helped drive the frenzy.
Well, as I understand it, coffee originated in the Middle East. That's why we have Arabica. But it seems to do best on mountains. There aren't too, I don't know how many mountains there are in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
But why, do we know why they do so well on mountains?
They, well, the plant is native to Ethiopia, to mountains in Ethiopia, about 5,000 feet or so, give or take a couple thousand feet. It needs to be in tropical highlands where it doesn't get too cold or too hot. It's very sensitive to both. So basically, if you look at where coffee grows around the world, it's a little band around the equator and only at high elevation. In fact, coffees are graded. The quality, it goes by the elevation.
So when it says mountain grown, then at least in theory, that's going to be better.
Right.
And although I'm not sure Uban is better than the kind I get.
There's more that goes into it. But generally, the really ethereal flavors happen when you climb up over 6,000 feet.
I'm assuming that people figured most of these things out a long time ago, long before the computers could tell us what would be the best place to grow something.
Oh, absolutely. There's always a lot of human tradition that comes behind any of these discoveries.
But what about now? Are computers telling people you should, you know, there's this area that would really do well with coffee and nobody's ever tried it?
With coffee, I don't know. I certainly know with, you know, wine in California and elsewhere that a lot of satellite imagery is being used to find the right combination of slope and soil and climate.
When we talk about wines, you know, the wine snobs say things like it has a taste of chocolate or a taste of saddle, or it has some raspberry in it or rose flavors. Is that what's coming out of the soil?
No, that's those plants will generate all sorts of compounds like as a reaction to different things. So it's not as if they're pulling flavors that are already in the soil through their roots and depositing them. But the way they react to different types of soil or to different types of weather causes them to produce all kinds of different compounds that taste different. And then often, it seems like yeast is often part of the game, whether it's cheese or wine, even maple syrup. Microbes are responsible for a big part of the flavor.
These are naturally occurring yeasts?
Yeah. Natural bacteria and other microbes in syrup are what make those yummy, kind of toasty flavors. With wines, you could make the wines were always made with naturally occurring indigenous yeasts until recently, when a lot of wineries switched to using yeasts that are created in labs.
My guest is Rowan Jacobson. His latest book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. It's published by Bloomsbury. Some of the foods you describe are either disappearing or being threatened by environmental factors. Alaskan salmon, we're seeing honeybees disappear. Oysters used to thrive in New York Harbor, and now they're they're trying to bring them back, but I'm not sure we're going to get that. Then, of course, the oil spill threatened an awful lot of the oysters and shrimp and everything in the Gulf of Mexico. Is terroir threatened to some degree?
I think it certainly is. A lot of cases of it. If we're growing more and more food in monocrops in fairly generic places, then flavor is threatened. We're losing all these flavors along the wayside, and memory is short. So one generation without those flavors, and no one even knows to miss them anymore.
To some degree, isn't this also because we have a lot of faith in technology? If nature lets us down, well, we can always find a way around it.
Right, and we can go into the lab, and the food scientists can create the flavor for us. But I think what you find is that nature has a lot of surprises and some really wonderful surprises that you're not going to make in a lab.
A listener wonders whether you can tell us the difference between terroir and regionalism.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Regionalism, the locavore movement is about eating locally. It's not necessarily about the flavor. It's about it's more of an environmental choice or a local economy choice. Terroir is just about the taste of different foods. So if I'm sitting in a restaurant in New York City and eating a piece of Yukon River King salmon and noticing that this salmon is much richer than any other salmon I've had, I'm paying attention to the regional flavor of a place that happens to be 4,000 miles away.
I experienced that in Seattle, where I went into a very unimpressive bar and ordered some salmon and had better salmon than I've had in practically any restaurant in New York other than the best of the best.
Yeah, there's a whole salmon culture in the Pacific Northwest that just has never quite made it here. In fact, when I was visiting the Yukon River folks, they told me that the best salmon goes down to Seattle or stays in Alaska, and then the salmon that swims farther upstream and uses up a lot of its fat, so it's not nearly as rich in flavor, they do one of two things with it. They either feed it to their dogs or they ship it to the East Coast.
Amy in Manhattan writes, I'm a little surprised that birch sap doesn't make good syrup. Is it something else from birch trees that goes into birch beer?
Yeah, that is the flavor you get in birch beer, kind of like a wintergreeny flavor. And it's good. Just the sap itself is actually pretty good. But it very quickly gets really bitter, especially when you boil it. Because the thing about maple syrup is that you take the sap that has about 2% sugar and you concentrate it. So it takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. And when you do that kind of concentration, any kind of weird flavor that's in there gets extremely magnified.
And then, of course, if you could make good waffles or pancakes, you have something that's called heaven.
Yeah, there you go.
We asked listeners on Facebook which foods reminded them of a certain place, and here are some of the answers that we got. San George cheese from the volcanic Azores, feta from my mother's village near Sparta, also feta from Crete, and tomatoes from upstate New York, bagels from New York, although I prefer bagels from Montreal.
That's a big debate.
We used to have these small bagels in New York, and now we have these big puffy bagels. Are they still called New York bagels?
And my understanding is that what made the New York bagel unique was the water. Is that true?
Well, that's what they used to say.
Montreal bagels are baked, rather. Uh-huh. It's a quite different process.
Somebody else asked about the recent development of seed banks, the effort to preserve certain flavors that might have gone extinct otherwise.
Yeah, this is huge, I think, because what terroir is always – interesting flavors are always basically a cooperative effort between a particular species or variety of something and a place. And if you're losing all these different varieties that have unique ways of living in a place, you're going to lose a lot of what makes food interesting.
We talked about terroir as a concept that the French applied to wines. In France, in Spain, in Italy, the regions that have these specific terroir sensibilities are heavily regulated. And you can't claim that you have a Burgundy if it doesn't come from Burgundy. And they even get more specific to little areas within Burgundy. Do we have anything like that happening in the United States?
Not to that extent, which I think is probably a good thing. That the regulations have been great in that they make sure that if you're tasting a particular wine from Burgundy, it's always going to be made the same way and it's always going to have that quality to it. But it's also – they've also – there's so many regulations with the production of wine and food in Europe that it's a little bit stultifying. Like nothing changes. So I kind of think of Europe as the museum with the great masterworks of terroir. But if you want to go to the galleries where there's no rules and people are trying all kinds of new interesting artwork with their foods and wines, come to the United States. Now, there is the closest thing I know of with wine to an appellation like they have in Europe is a place in California called Bien Nacido, which is one of the only – it's a valley that has – produces quite distinctive wines, very different than the usual California style. And many wineries make wines with the grapes from Bien Nacido, but you'll always see it on the label, Bien Nacido. And actually, we'll be drinking some tonight at a dinner I'm doing at Savoy.
Well, you can't claim something as a bourbon unless it comes from Kentucky. We've applied some of those rules. You've included a number of recipes with your book. These are recipes from the different terroirs?
Yeah. Each chapter in the book, I focus on a different food, whether chocolate or honey or oysters. And then I try to provide some recipes that, to me, bring out the essence of that particular food in that place.
And the book, American Terroir, is published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much, Rowan Jacobson, for being on our show. And it's been a pleasure talking about terroir and hearing somebody pronounce it correctly.
You better than me.